Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Welcome, Shay Belsky, to the Autism Roundtable. You come with many hats in the autism community. Can you please introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about your personal and professional background.
Absolutely. My name is Shay Belsky. I am an autistic self-advocate. I currently work for HubSpot as a tech lead, and my past experience has taken me to companies like Wayfair, Google, IBM. And I was also previously a startup chief technology officer working for an organization called Mantra, which is a neurodiversity employment network.
And now currently, I believe you also host your own podcast. Is that correct?
I am also a podcast host. I'm not quite used to saying that out loud. It's new-ish as of February, but I do also host my own podcast about being neurodivergent in the tech industry. It's called Autistic Techie. Very fun name. And I talk a lot about what it means to operate in the workplace, how you can kind of hack your way and hack your brain to thrive a little bit more on the job and in life.
Fascinating. Okay. Thank you so much for coming on today and sharing all of your experiences with us. So tell us a little bit about how you feel autism affects you on a day-to-day basis. You've gone very far in life and as you just said, really made it in the world. So tell us a little bit about how it affects you on a day-to-day basis. And if you even want to rewind a little bit and tell us a little bit how it was growing up till now adulthood, how it's changed.
It really varies based on a situation. I would say at this point in my life, most of how it affects me is at a sensory and social level. Like I was just at a dinner party type of thing the other night, and I was talking with somebody and they were like spelling things out in like a different language, and I was trying to like picture the word in my head as far as what they were spelling, but there was like a mistranslation occurring in my own head and I was having a hard time piecing together what they were actually saying. And I was like, oh, like, I'm sorry to make you repeat yourself like 20 times. I'm autistic. So like the way that it's being heard in my brain is a little bit weird. And I'm like, oh, and this person was like, oh, I know a bunch of autistic people. I picked that up pretty early. Meanwhile, at the other end of the table, someone totally different was like, no, there's no way you're autistic. So it's really weird as far as how people expect me to be autistic. I would say when I was in school, when I was like in middle school, high school, my social and sensory struggles were much stronger. They affected me more day to day. And I also think I was less aware of what my triggers were, what would cause me to have a breakdown or a meltdown. And I was less aware of how to self-regulate. I think now I'm a lot more aware of the things that give me the ick and I can avoid them or at least be prepared for them. But when I was a middle schooler, high schooler, I had very little idea of what those triggers were. And I would unknowingly walk right into them and then become very dysregulated.
What was helpful in your journey in learning to identify the triggers until today? Like, what mythologies do you find really work to help you to stay regulated?
I'm a big person in like the spoon theory or like the social battery theory. I am pretty like self-aware of my social battery and what it means to say, okay, I know I have this much juice in a tank and I need to be able to expend that and spend it very carefully. And if I don't, then I'm going to like go into low battery mode, as I like to call it. A few weekends ago, we had just come from like a very big socialization event. It was a lot of networking, a lot of talking with family, a lot of stuff like that. And I could feel like my social battery just like dwindling. And we had to go into one of my least favorite places, which is the grocery store. And not only that, but like grocery store at like Sunday at 4 p.m. And I joke with my wife, it's like, I don't love supermarkets at that time because it's like busy, it's chaos, it's mayhem. And we had to go in. And I'm like, I'm going to be okay going into the situation, but like I'm kind of conserving energy. Don't expect me to like talk or interact or like react to you unless I need to tell you something. I'm just going to kind of be like operating with as little energy as I can in this supermarket. And I think she really appreciated the analogy and just a heads up that like, hey, I'm kind of like in survival mode here. So don't expect a lot from me, just so I can kind of get through this experience.
Wow. Wow. Was there any specific therapies that helped you get there, or was this all self-work?
I had an IEP when I was in school. I had OT, PT, speech therapy when I was in school as well. And that helped a lot as far as finding my identity, finding my communication style, and also like becoming more aware of those triggers. I would say more of my self-awareness for self-regulation and the things that have bothered me came about much more when I was in college, when I was more on my own and forced to make these choices on my own and say, okay, like, what's actually bothering me here? Do I have the ability to just modify this environment to leave or go do something else and kind of see the before and after? So it was definitely a mixture of having gone through a lot of therapy when I was much younger, and then also having the independence to try things for myself once I became an adult and was at the point where I could do this.
Wow. And I like how that piece where the independence, you know, sometimes as parents, we want to almost like helicopter and help our children and be there to handhold always. And for you, being independent is sort of what gave you your wings.
Yes, but I would not have become independent without my parents, 100%. Like, they are the reason that I am here today to be able to talk about this in a way that is articulate. In every IEP meeting, they were there. For every therapy, they made sure that I got what I needed. I would not be here without my parents. So my parents enabled me to become independent, and I would not be here without them. I caveat that all the time.
That's beautiful.
Sure, I sound like I'm on my own here, but I don't think I would be anywhere near as successful of thriving as I am had I not had such supportive, strong, and kind parents as mine are.
Wow, that's beautiful. I'm tearing up as a mom listening to you say that. That's beautiful. I'm sure they're going to love listening to this and hearing that. Wow. Okay, and then tell us a little bit about, you said you have a wife, so tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, we met February 1st, 2020, right before COVID hit. That was an interesting time for me because I'd come off of a relationship. I was kind of figuring out, like, what do I want as far as a relationship? What am I looking for in a long-term partner? And just kind of figuring things out myself. I had been dating on and off for a year at that point, but we hit it off really well in February. And this was when we could still, like, do normal things, like pre-COVID. We did a dinner at the top of the Prudential Center in Boston. We did ice skating. We went to a cidery. We did a lot of running. And then, like, about a month and a half into dating, COVID happened and everything shut down and everything changed. And something we did, which was a very unique COVID experience, was we, like, lived with each other for, like, a week and a half. And knowing her for less than 2 months, I'm like, this will either go really well or really poorly. But I'm glad that we had that chance to be around each other as closely as we were in that time, because it taught me a lot about being in a relationship, and it also reinforced that relationship that ended up becoming extremely strong over the course of the next few years.
Is your wife neurodiverse as well, or?
She's neurotypical.
She's neurotypical. Okay. And do you feel like the language you speak is similar?
I think it really depends. Something that is important to note is that she went to school for physical therapy. So she's been, like, aware of neurodiversity, but not as intimately as she is now. When I first told her that I was autistic, she was definitely surprised. She had no indication, no nothing. And something that I always appreciate about her is that she took time to understand, to ask me good questions, and to support me as best I needed to. With the caveat, I think, that I needed to be confident in talking to her and being honest with her. I think that is what has helped her the most, is my ability to talk to her, but then also seeing that feedback that it comes back to me. I think it's a positively reinforcing feedback cycle. Like, over the course of a relationship, I opened up to her more and more and more because I saw that she was, like, responding to what I was saying, and it wasn't falling flat as had happened in past relationships where I felt like I had to compromise a lot on myself and the other person in the relationship wasn't necessarily bending in a similar direction.
Wow. Okay, so the last time we spoke, Shay, you had brought up Love on the Spectrum.
Yes.
And I had started and I said, I didn't love it. And then you said, no, you need to go into season two and three. And right after that, I started season two and I watched every single episode. I even went back to season one and watched it as well. What are your thoughts on Love on the Spectrum and relationships in general when it comes to the autistic community?
I think production specifically has gotten a lot better over the seasons because I think they emphasize a lot more of how this is the wide variety in which autistic people live and thrive. Some of them are independent, some of them live with their parents, some of them have very strong special interests and they are celebrated and they are really lifted up. Other people have jobs, they have occupations, and they're very independent. It really depends a lot on the individual. And I think what I have come to respect more about that show is that it paints a broader picture. Obviously, I think there's room to improve. I do wonder, could they include folks that maybe don't aren't a part of the traditional autism demographic? What I mean is, like, could they include non-speakers? Could they include people who have other sorts of comorbidity conditions at the same time? I think that would go an even further way to painting the whole picture about autism, but I think where they are right now is a good starting point.
And in relationships in general, what sort of advice would you give to the neurodiverse population? Or do you feel that everyone's so individual, there's not so much advice to give?
I think, as evidenced by my own relationship, I think the number one thing to impart advice on is to be honest with your partner, because if you are going to build a very long-term relationship with them, they have to be able to support you, to provide positive feedback, and also to be able to tell you things that might be uncomfortable, that might be difficult. And you, as a person, have to be prepared and ready for that to occur. And if you're not, maybe you're not ready for a relationship. It's a hard pill to swallow. But I think you have to be able to take it two ways. If I'm in a relationship and somebody is doing something that bothers me, I am confident that I can say that to someone. But then you have to be ready to hear it back the other direction.
True. I guess also, like, sort of in all relationships, we have to have a give and take and really great open communication. So I guess it goes in all relationships, sort of that we have to work on that relationship, nurture that relationship, and really invest in it.
Yeah, like my wife and I talk about everything. We communicate about everything. And I think that's a reason for our strong relationship is because we don't, there's no secrets. I think I kept a secret from her once, and that was when I was proposing to her. That was it. And like other little things about the wedding and proposal, but those are acceptable secrets in relationships. But I do think that we've really thrived because we are very honest and transparent with each other about everything. And we don't like raise our voices. We don't shout. We don't yell. We seek to understand and we seek to build a positive communication. And I think that really is a strong facet of our relationship.
Yes, and relationships take work. That's the truth. Like, no relationship just goes and is easy. We have to all like nurture it. So I love all the components you mentioned. Okay, tell us a little bit about your work. So you started with like a whole laundry list. So go through a little bit with what you're doing now, and then you could tell us your history of how you got there.
So I went to Cornell University and I did a bunch of internships there. I interned at IBM for 2 summers. I interned at Google. Google is an interesting experience. I enjoyed my time there a lot, but I think that was my first like really big mega tech company. And that taught me a lot about my own self-advocacy and how I communicate about autism to other people. It was the first time I had a job where I felt like it was necessary for me to disclose it because I felt as though I needed something that I wasn't getting. And I didn't know that I needed it until after the fact. And I'm like, okay, this is like actually something that's going on in my environment. I need to be ready for this. That's not to Google's discredit. I just didn't have the self-awareness at the time to be able to have this conversation confidently. And it didn't go well when I did have it. And again, that's not Google's fault. That was just me not being mature enough to fully understand what was happening.
explain to us what happens in this situation where you felt that you were not prepared. So what was the interaction or interactions that you were not prepared for?
The biggest thing was that my manager didn't know that I was autistic. And over the course of my time there, I was there for about 3 months or so. I felt that there were parts of our relationship that I think were not going in the right direction because I think I was like unable to pick up on context clues, unable to pick up on like social nits and bits in a conversation. And I think there were some like cognitively complex things that I was doing that I think could have been smoothed over had a discussion about neurodiversity been had beforehand, had they been trained on neurodiversity, had they had an awareness and understanding beforehand. And again, this isn't to their discredit. They didn't know anything. And I do know that Google does provide a sort of training to managers and to teams when they know that somebody coming in is autistic. I learned about that after I had joined Google and not before. And I think had I been more upfront and honest about that, I think that situation would have turned out differently. Because what I did end up realizing was that like most people who were autistic and applied at Google apply for like a separate hiring process, a separate interview process. And I didn't have that process because I didn't talk about it during my interview. And because of that, my interview was more challenging. My internship in general was more challenging, I think. At least it was more challenging for me and my brain. And had I think I'd been more honest and upfront about that, that would have been a different story. But that also would have required me to be aware of why do I want to talk about me being autistic? Because I don't like just slinging it out there to say it, because I don't think that that's necessarily productive. I think there has to be a why. Like, what change do I need to affect by me saying that I'm autistic? Do I need an accommodation? Do I need my manager to understand? Do I need support from my team? Like, what do I need because I am autistic? And I think I didn't have an answer to that question. I didn't know that I should ask the question at all. And as a result, I think I struggled not even knowing the question to ask.
Wow. Wow. So, and that, 1 second, Google was your first job, is that what you said, or IBM?
That was an internship. IBM was my first internship. That was a lot less stressful, I think. And that's the nature of the two companies. Google is a lot more of a competitive tech company than IBM was. IBM, I did not have the same issues. That was the nature of the work, the nature of where I was as well. In IBM, I interned in Massachusetts, close to home, in New York, close to home. In Google, I was on the other side of the country in Mountain View, California, in the Bay Area. So that already added a layer of stress that I didn't know was going to be stressful until I ended up there, honestly.
Okay, 2020 hindsight, and giving advice to those that are maybe in similar positions to you. What could you have done differently? And when do you think it is appropriate to self-advocate to, you know, like you said, like put your diagnosis out there versus when do you feel like just going with the flow and being not labeling yourself is better? Like, where do you draw that line?
I think it's always important to self-advocate when you know what you have to self-advocate for. Going into a Google internship, I didn't know what I wanted to say about me being autistic, so I didn't say anything. That doesn't mean there wasn't anything to say. I just didn't have a strong enough confidence in myself and communication to be able to take that to where it had to go. And I wish that I'd had a little more self-awareness and honesty with myself about like what could actually come up here. And I also think that me being an intern and me only having really had like two previous tech roles that could have had any basis for comparison, I didn't really have a basis for comparison to say, this bothered me in my last internships and I want to fix that here. Because IBM was fine and great. I didn't expect Google to go any differently until after the fact. And I'd wished that I had had a little bit more of that exposure, but I also couldn't have gotten much more exposure to it in the first place. And the point of an internship is to gain that exposure in the first place. So I'm glad that it happened in an internship in a controlled environment where at least it's time boxed to 3 months and not at a full-time job where I could have ended up burning out or getting fired or something.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so you picked up from there after Google. You learned a lot of lessons in Google, I guess. Yes. Life lessons, right?
Yes.
And where'd you go after Google?
I graduated from Cornell and I went to work at Wayfair. That was my first actual big real tech company. And at Wayfair was where I actually became much more confident in saying, okay, like, I want to say that I'm autistic and this is what I need to get out of that scenario. And what was unique about Wayfair was that I had 5 managers in my first year there for various different reasons. That actually was a blessing in disguise, as stressful as it was, because it gave me the chance to iterate and practice me saying to a manager that I was autistic and this is what I need to get out of this relationship. Because I could see like what landed, what resonated, what were they able to do. That was a very helpful situation for me.
Can I ask you, like, what do you say to the manager? Like, say I'm the manager and you want to get your message across. What is that? Like, just for those listening out there who might need some little ideas or confidence in doing it. Like, say I'm the manager and you want to come in and you want to relate to me that you're autistic and obviously there's a purpose for it. What is it that you're going to say to me?
First off, everyone's different. So what I'm going to say applies to me. Like, take this with a grain of salt and apply to your own experiences, but don't use this copy-paste because everybody is different. But what I would say at my first company was like, hey, Mr. or Mrs. Manager, I want you to know that I am autistic. What this means to you is that the way in which I express my ideas, the way in which I communicate, the way in which I socialize might be different to what you expect. Like, I understand that taking information in a way that's different than other people is. That doesn't mean that it's like any better or any worse than others. It just might be different. I might ask you to repeat yourself sometimes, and I might sometimes get information on the first try. This does mean that I need a little bit more focused help and some specific performance development on like communicating, giving speeches and stuff like that. So I really want to focus a lot of my performance development in those areas where I know that I'm weak and I want to pay a special attention to those areas. And I got it to that point because it made it very easy for them. Like, number one, I told them things up front. I told them what to expect. And I said, this is what I want out of the relationship. It makes it very easy for them to then go to bat for me and advocate for me to get me any accommodations that I needed and just figure stuff out from there.
And I like the fact that you put yourself out there and you're like, I want to do professional development in any place that I might be weak. So that also gives like a manager like that feeling like, hey, I'm working towards fitting in whatever way I need to fit in. But I do have this set of this really just a personality, the set of different like accommodations that I might need here and there, but I'm bringing you great work and let's just communicate in a way that I could communicate. So I love that. And I love how you say it with confidence and it's really taking you through.
But I had to iterate on that. Like, I didn't get that way overnight. Like, I had to try that multiple times. And again, it's odd and more of an outlier, an anomaly that I had 5 managers tread on in 1 year. Some people don't get that chance at all. So I am thankful for the fact that I had a chance to iterate on it, but not thankful for the fact that I had a lot of fresh in my performance development because it was multiple different people trying to maintain continuity.
Wow. Very interesting experiences and great insight.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happened after Wayfair?
I went to go work for HubSpot for the first time. I was working there for about 10 months or so, and HubSpot was an amazing experience as well. When I interviewed there, they were like, oh, let us know if we need any accommodations. We had talked about neurodiversity. It was on my like LinkedIn. I was out there already at that point, so it wasn't like they were going to miss it. But it came up and we had a great conversation about it. We have a couple different people in the interview and people were really supportive, really kind and on top of it. And I always felt really included and that I belonged on HubSpot. And the only reason that I left there the first time was because I went to go do Mentra. Mentra is the employment network for neurodivergent professionals. I left HubSpot in March 2022 to go work there as their technical founder and CTO. And that was a big deal to me. Like, this resonates. This is personally relevant to me and matters. I have experienced the problems that we're trying to solve here. And I love this. And I wanted to really make it a big thing and take it to where it had to go.
Are you still currently at Mentra?
No. So
Oh, wait, so but don't move off of Mentra yet. So tell us a little bit about what you were doing at Mentra and what the goal of Mentra was.
Yes. So I was at Mentra for 2.5 years. And in that role, the point of Mentra is to connect neurodivergent job seekers of gainful employment to major Fortune 500 employers who wanted to make their hiring processes, make their candidate pool more equitable and more neurodiverse, for lack of a better word. And in my role as CTO, I ran an engineering organization. I was talking with employers all the time as far as how they could really further neurodiversity within their companies. I led the team. I worked cross-functionally with people in and out of the company. It was a lot of different jobs, a lot of different responsibilities, and I enjoyed it, the role. I really had an amazing time there, and I felt that I could also make it my own. I was able to, set my working hours, was able to have a lot more control over how I worked best, but then also made sure I respected the working preferences, working styles of my direct reports. At Mentra, I led a team of 4 engineers, 3 of whom were neurodivergent, and I made sure that they all had the emotional safety, the working style, whatever they needed to work the way that their brains worked, knowing that everybody's brain works a little bit differently.
Amazing. When you say emotional safety, what do you mean by that?
Them feeling like they could come to me with any questions, if they had concerns, if they needed to confide in me, that I was there to do that, and that they had the peace of mind knowing that I wouldn't retaliate, that I would take them seriously, and that I would just really maintain a level of safety with them to talk about whatever it was.
Whatever it was. Have that open feeling of and safe feeling.
I wanted them to see me as somebody who they could trust.
Wow. Wow. So this was your first job where you were a team leader.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. And tell us a little bit about the piece of finding jobs. Did you only do the tech part of it? Or like you said, you did interact with a lot of different people in the company as well.
Yes.
Were you, what sort of product was being introduced here? And what do you think they did well on? What do you think that they could have improved on?
The application itself, the platform, is a onboarding process for job seekers, telling you about traditional things, giving you resume, giving work experience, but then also assets and facets about being neurodivergent that are unique to them. What are your working preferences? What accommodations do you need? Tell us about your brain, how you think, how you operate, kind of going beyond a traditional job application to make it much more bespoke, much more unique. And we would then match job seekers to employers based on what they were looking for, based on what was about their job, based about the company, and just trying to create a meaningful, good fit based off of the job seeker and the job itself.
Wow. Do you think they do a good job at it? Is there anything that you would have sort of encouraged if, say, you would go open your own one?
Something that I think is very important in a job seeking process is that level of self-advocacy, self-communication. I think that is kind of the step one to effectively being able to use Mentra. And I wish that I had gotten to spend more time focusing on helping people recognize in themselves what's going on, what do I need, and being able to recognize that and also be honest about it. I think sometimes people check a box without knowing what it means, or they'll say they want to, but they don't really, or they leave something blank and they actually do need that. And if I was going to go do my own thing in the future, I would really want to help neurodivergent people discover themselves. What do you actually need? What is actually bothering you? What are your triggers? What prompts you to experience a breakdown or a meltdown? And how can you avoid those in the future, either through self-regulation, through changing your environment, or for other adjustments and accommodations? I think that is step zero of even using anything LinkedIn or Mentra or Indeed or something like that.
Is it also to understand yourself first so that you know what job you should be looking for?
That too. I think sometimes people apply for jobs they're not cut out for, and that's just painful reality of it. And I know a lot of people who are neurodivergent who have a burning passion to do one kind of job, but they don't actually know if that's going to be problematic or not. And I would be do you want to try it first before you spend a lot of your time studying for this or applying to jobs? And then they go do it and they're oh, wow, actually, I hate this. I'm not going to do that. And Yeah, and it's a painful reality, but at least then they know they hate it. Like, if somebody really wants to be a user experience designer, but they hate using a stylus or they hate, like, being on the computer, maybe that's not for them. And that's okay. Like, not everybody can do every job. But don't force yourself into something because you think you like to do it without knowing if you're going to be liking doing it.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. I love the different components, and I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of anxiety that comes with job seeking as well. Do you feel like that there's a component of like anxiety that individuals come to the job force with?
Absolutely. Like it's funny because I just recorded an episode about masking for my own show. And I think masking is a very important and distressing experience of job seeking and being on the job. It's behaving or acting in a way that you are expected to, that maybe isn't authentic to who you are and what you actually want to accomplish. And I have had to mask in interviews. I had to mask on a job before. And it is sometimes a painful experience. I think there are some situations where masking isn't always a bad thing. But I think by and large, it is a distressing experience to people. And it's I hate that it is necessary because it can be really problematic, to be honest with you.
So when masking, what is the experience? Like how do you feel when you feel that you need to go into masking mode? And I agree with you, by the way, I'm in school now to become a behavioral analyst, and the literature is saying that the masking it doesn't have good internal effects on people, that it definitely has been proven to have negative effects. But I guess like you're saying, sometimes we feel we need a mask in order to be in society.
Yeah. I think what becomes problematic about masking is that it feels very formulaic. It feels a little bit robotic. Sometimes you have to remember what is being expected of you. You have to remember to shake somebody's hand. Hi, how are you? How's your family? It feels less organic, and that's problematic. And I am good at masking. I use air quotes right here only because I remember to do these things over and over and over. I'm going to a family event, like, hi, how are you? Here's a hug. How are you doing? I feel like I'm kind of checking boxes off of a list, and it doesn't necessarily feel like it's natural to me. I know that I have to. It isn't painful for me to do that, but it isn't like burst forth into my mind organically that I feel a compulsion to do this. I ask these questions because I know it is expected of me to do this, not necessarily because I feel this burning desire to do so. I also know that it would be worse if I did not do this, if I came off as being cold or unsocial. And I just know that I have to give people what they want.
Sort of push through in order to fit into society.
Basically. And the way that I do it isn't necessarily unnatural. Like I actively behave in a way people expect me to, but the way that that kind of comes forth is sometimes a little bit forced, for lack of a better word.
And how do you feel like inside? Like, what are your emotions going on when you're masking?
Again, I guess the best expression is like that it does feel like I'm checking boxes. That like I have to remember, what am I trying to do here? What is my goal? And what do I have to do to accomplish that goal? And the episode that's coming out soon, I talk about like, what's your formula? What are you putting into this equation? What are other people putting into the equation? And what's the outcome that you're trying to get at? And I think when I'm masking, I have to think about, like, what are the steps that I have to put into this? What are my ingredients? And how can I balance it with other people's ingredients, their own presence, and figuring it out from there? Because it could be really stressful if I'm not, like, aware of what I need to do and what other people are already doing.
Wow. So when you're saying checking boxes, it sounds to me like you're saying that it's almost like you're on a job, like you're doing what's needed versus what your internal pull would be, which would be what? Like to just be in your own space?
Like if I'm at a networking event, if I'm at a conference, something that's a little bit more corporate and I'm talking with strangers, I have to be like, okay, I've got to talk to this person. Hi, how are you? How's your family? How is this project you're doing? I have to like remember the socially acceptable things to ask them so I don't come off as like rude or abrupt, because I would sometimes just want to get to the chase and ask them a question. But some people need a little bit more pampering, a little bit more flowery, and I have to be aware of that going into a conversation. Like, does this person need some more pampering? Do I have to ask them about these other things before it gets to the point? Does this other person want to cut right to the chase? Every person is different. So I think I have to look at it from a very formulaic way. That helps me in my brain. That's not for everybody. Some people don't do any of that. But the way that I approach it can seem a little bit structured for something that isn't always a structured thing. But that's just how my brain operates.
Wow. Wow. Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that with us. I always like wanted to kind of know what this, like, how an autistic person might feel with this masking, because I get to read it as literature, but you get to have it as your like day-to-day real life.
I experience masking pretty much every day. I think at this point, I've gotten a lot of it down to the point where it doesn't feel as robotic. I think I do feel like natural conversation. I do remember these things instinctively, and I don't have to worry as much about it seeming as robotic and forced. Sometimes I have to definitely remember those things, but I would say it's a lot less taxing than it used to be.
Wow. Wow. And on the sensory end of things, do you feel like you need are there any sensory components that you feel you need a mask or change throughout your day?
It depends. I wear headphones when I'm working a lot. That definitely helps with sound input. Like if I'm in an office, I will almost always wear headphones to manage sound that's coming in. That's because like my brain will just pick up sounds that are coming from other places, and like I can't like filter the sounds out. I don't really have the ability to like tune somebody or tune something out. I just hear it whether I like it or not. And as a result, I have to manage that by wearing headphones and doing stuff like that. Even if I'm kind of out by myself, I'll still wear them just to kind of manage and self-regulate that way.
Well, being in the tech world, it might not look so strange that you walk around with headphones.
True. But like I still do it for me, whether or not people agree with it. Like I do it because it helps me and supports me, not because people expect me to.
Love that. And what is your thoughts on others and their thoughts and feelings? Like in fitting into the world, like it seems like you have a really healthy self-esteem in viewing yourself within the world. What are your thoughts on that?
I think having an important level of trust in myself is very important. And the self-esteem stems from self-reflection, it stems from understanding. Like, I know that I am able to get to where I am today because I'm confident that I can ask for what I need and I can be decisive about it. My wife and I talk about like being decisive about like getting what you want, and also recognizing that in the best case scenario, if you ask for something and don't get it, the worst thing that can happen is nothing. And I think that that terminology, the worst thing that can happen is nothing, has really helped me a lot to overcome a lot of my anxiety and fear. Because if I try something and it doesn't work and I go back to where I started, I didn't lose anything other than time and effort. And that has radically transformed my self-confidence and self-esteem. I would go out there and put myself out there to do things I wouldn't normally do, because assuming that the cost to me was time and effort and hopefully little else, then it's worth attempting, it's worth trying. And over time, hopefully I get better at it and I want to do it again. I want to do a podcast again. I want to talk again. I want to do something again. And that helps me reinforce the things that I know I'm good at and improve in things that I'm not.
Love that. I love your drive.
It stems a lot just from stubborn effort, I would say.
Yeah, you keep on going. You find the things that work for you. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Really amazing. Okay, so after Mentra, where'd you go next?
I am back at HubSpot. They call it boomeranging in tech. I boomeranged back to HubSpot, and I've been there since September 2024.
Okay, and what are you doing at HubSpot?
I am still a lead. I am a tech lead at HubSpot, which is managing a small team of engineers, helping them with their performance coaching, helping them with planning out small to long-term planning is what we're actually working on, collaborating with other cross-functional folks again. A lot of the same stuff that I did with Mentra, but with a lot less breadth, I would say. I'm only responsible for my team and not like HubSpot writ large.
Excellent. So you went right back. That's cool.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your podcast. What inspired you to start a podcast?
I've been on a bazillion podcasts before, and I like talking about this stuff all the time. And I'm like, I want to get up and talk about this, but I didn't really want to like pursue like the professional speaking path because it's just a lot of time and effort and energy that I didn't necessarily have to give. But I'm at home pretty frequently. I have a thesis set up, so let's just do a podcast. Because I had a lot of things to talk about, and I still do have things to talk about. And there's lots of other people in this industry who would love to talk about them with me. And I started it back in February, and we're about 20 episodes deep at this point, roughly 20 episodes deep. And it's just been really positive. Gotten so much positive feedback. People have listened to it. People really seem to resonate with it. I post clips from it on TikTok and Instagram. People resonate with it there. Like, people are really taking what I'm saying very authentically. And I think I approach it in a way that I'm talking with people and not necessarily at them. I try to make it like approachable and personable for folks and for listeners. And I think that really helps. People appreciate like practical feedback and anecdotes and perspectives about this is what I did in my job. This is what I did when I was in this situation. And I think that has landed with people where it seems a lot more approachable.
Wow. Wow. Love that. And it's true. You know, when you have information to share and you go ahead and share it, you know, you change so many different people's lives. So that's amazing work that you're doing.
Yeah. I've really enjoyed it. And it helps me as well, like, stay accountable too. Like, I will get people who like correct me on things or help me address situations I made a mistake on. It helps me learn as well. People will be very, very easy at telling me that I may have gotten a fact wrong, and it's easy to correct.
Yeah. Oh, I love my podcast for that reason too. I learn new things every day. Even today, talking to you, I learned new things. Yeah, it's so amazing. It definitely opens up a whole world of people in an industry that you're super interested in. So get to learn on the job. It's the best.
Exactly.
That's wonderful. Okay, so in person, you spoke about difficulty with like social interacting and masking, but on say a podcast, are you in a different space that you feel more comfortable in, or you're also in a space where sometimes maybe you have to do some sort of masking?
Like when I'm recording my own show or someone else's show, like I control my physical environment. I can control a lot about what I'm doing here. Like this is my headphones, my microphone, like I'm standing, like the environment is under my control, and that helps a lot. And when I run my own show, I say to people, hey, like, if you need to self-regulate, if you need to do anything, if you want your video off, like, whatever helps people feel more authentic and comfortable, I provide that for that. Because I know that I would do the same thing for me, too. Like, I know that if I needed my video off for some reason, I would ask for it. I would say so. In general, I don't, but, like, if for some reason one day I needed to be video off and not have to stare at myself or stare at someone else, then I would ask for that. And I set the tone for them. That way they know it's okay. When I'm on other shows, it's the same deal.
You taught me something new today. That's great. No, I like that. What kind of guests are you bringing on?
I've brought a lot of people from all different corners. I've had people who have done startups. I've brought in ADHD coaches. I've brought in folks who work more traditional tech. I've worked folks who are very principled in their careers. It's been a very wide range because tech is a wide range and neurodiversity is a wide range. Like, I don't want to pigeonhole into just one part of tech or one part of neurodiversity. I also want to bring on like more allies and people who aren't necessarily neurodivergent themselves, but work with people who are. I interviewed somebody recently who is a parent to somebody who is dyslexic. And I thought that was a very resonating conversation because they talked a lot about their advocacy in the workplace, which I don't think comes up very often, that they are dyslexic themselves, but their child is. And as a result, they were able to talk about it more effectively in the workplace, and they have a show of their own. So we had a great conversation about what does that mean as a parent? And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. I love how you're so, you highlight the self-advocacy so greatly, and that you feel that there's a void in the world of the advocacy. What is your feeling on the awareness that's out there in the world, and how people react to individuals with autism?
I think it's a complicated question with a complicated answer because everybody knows somebody who's autistic. They may not know that they know somebody. And I think that's sets a lot of interesting precedent because pretty much everybody in my personal life knows I'm autistic because I won't shut up about it. But for other people, they may not know that somebody close to them is autistic. And that autistic person may not know that they're autistic, whether it's a lack of access to diagnosis, they're socially unacceptable, they don't want to, or they've been told it's a bad thing to be associated with it. So I think there's just a lack of social acceptance about autism that stunts and precludes a lot of people from becoming really accepting and understanding of it. Like, I saw a Reddit post the other day where there was somebody who just got an adult diagnosis, but their parents had been told that they were autistic at like elementary school level, and their parents refused to do anything about it because they thought that it was damaging. And this person could have had a very different trajectory in their life had they known about their being autistic from a very early point. And it bothers me that people are still so resistant to this idea that autism is always a damaging or troubling thing. That doesn't mean that it is always a good thing either. I think the notion that autism is a superpower always is a harmful stereotype. I think every autistic person has different strengths and different challenges. And it is not fair to say that it's always a strength or always a challenge. It really varies based on the person. But above all of that, it just comes down to individuals and people supporting autistic people in whatever way those strengths or challenges look like.
And why do you think that sometimes parents are hesitant to, say, give the child a diagnosis? I'm an occupational therapist, and I have parents all the time that come in. There's an autism diagnosis in their medical chart, and they're like, she doesn't know. Don't tell her. And I always, like, wonder, like, what is the thought process there?
I mean, I can't speak from a medical perspective. I'm not a doctor, but from the perspective of somebody who is autistic, who knows autistic people and people who have been early, mid, late diagnosed, there is a fear of being treated differently, of always having this label, of not being able to push past something and not being able to move beyond being the autistic person. And or the way that I see it, the way that I experience it, is that you don't necessarily have to push past it or move beyond it, but you can embrace it and make it a part of you and become at peace of it, so that it does not, like, fully define you, but that you achieve an equilibrium or achieve a sense of peace with it, rather than letting it dominate and contort or distort how you live life, how people live life with you. Like, I live a very peaceful life with my wife, and I don't think I'd be able to do that if I wasn't honest with her about me being autistic. Same with my parents and family. Like, they're fully aware of me being autistic and how that affects me and decisions and choices that I make and how I communicate. Sometimes I can say or do things that I don't mean to that could come off as not being great, but I may not know any better. And they understand that to an extent. And other people around me too understand that to an extent, that sometimes my brain just doesn't work the way that theirs do. And they appreciate and understand that because there's a basis for it, but I still have the chance to make it mine.
Right. And I feel like for parents that choose not to share the diagnosis with their children, it could be confusing for the child as to why they might be struggling with all these different kinds of things.
Yeah, it could be frustrating for the kids too. Like, I know more and more kids these days who are in their own IEP meetings, who are participants in those meetings, and I wish that I had done that. I was given the chance to do that, and I didn't take that opportunity, and I wish that I had.
Wow. Yeah, I do believe it. And I also think that exactly that, including the child, the adult, in planning and decision-making is the only real way to do it, because we're all so individual. And, like,
everyone's different.
Exactly. Well, you have been so fascinating today, and I enjoyed all the information that you shared with us. If you had one message that you would leave off with to individuals on the autism spectrum, caregivers of individuals on the autism spectrum, what would your message be?
Be kind to yourself and be kind to people around you. I think it's easy to assume that people are malicious or that they're ignorant, but that is rarely the case. Just be kind and be compassionate.
Love that. Concise, right to it. Be compassionate to everybody. I love that. Thank you, Shay. You were fascinating. Now I have to go listen to all your podcasts.
You can find it anywhere you listen to shows. Autistic Techie.
Autistic Taggy. Okay, now I'm going to have to go listen. Thank you so much for coming on. And I think you shared such nice thoughts and feelings and perspective with our listeners. So I really thank you for that.
Of course. Thank you for having me.